It was thought that the Indians, once the only occupants of the continent, then pushed back and annihilated by the white invaders, would not be heard from again. In the last days of the year 1890, shortly after Christmas, the last massacre of Indians took place at Pine Ridge, South Dakota, near Wounded Knee Creek. Sitting Bull, the Great Sioux leader, had just been assassinated by Indian police in the pay of the United States, and the remaining Sioux sought refuge at Pine Ridge, 120 men and 230 women and children, surrounded by U.S. cavalry, with two Hotchkiss guns, capable of hurling shells over 2 miles, on a rise overlooking the camp. When the troopers ordered the Indians to turn over their weapons, one of them fired his rifle. The soldiers then let loose with their carbines, and the big guns on the hill shelled the teepees. When it was over, between 200 and 300 of the original 350 men, women, and children were dead. The 25 soldiers who died were mostly hit by their own shrapnel or bullets, since the Indians had only a few guns. The Indian tribes, attacked, subdued, starved out, had been divided up by putting them on reservations where they lived in poverty. In 1887, an Allotment Act tried to break up the reservations into small plots of land owned by individual Indians to turn them into American-type small farmers, but much of this land was taken by white speculators and the reservations remained. Then, during the New Deal, with a friend of the Indians, John Collier, in charge of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, there was an attempt to restore tribal life. But in the decades that followed, no fundamental change took place. Many Indians stayed on the impoverished reservations. The younger ones often left. An Indian anthropologist said, "An Indian reservation is the most complete colonial system in the world that I know about." For a time, the disappearance or amalgamation of the Indians seemed inevitable. Only 300,000 were left at the turn of the century, from the original million or more in the area of the United States. But then the population began to grow again, as if a plant left to die refused to do so, began to flourish. By 1960, there were 800,000 Indians, half on reservations, half in towns all over the country. The autobiographies of Indians show their refusal to be absorbed by the white man's culture. One wrote, "Oh yes, I went to the white man's schools. I learned to read from school books, newspapers, and the Bible. But in time I found that these were not enough. Civilized people depend too much on man-made printed pages. I turned to the Great Spirit's book, which is the whole of his creation." A Hopi Indian named Sun Chief said, "I had learned many English words and could recite part of the Ten Commandments. I knew how to sleep on a bed, pray to Jesus, comb my hair, eat with a knife and fork, and use a toilet. I had also learned that a person thinks with his head instead of his heart." Chief Luther Standing Bear, in his 1933 autobiography, From the Land of the Spotted Eagle, wrote, "True, the white man brought great change, but the varied fruits of his civilization, though highly colored and inviting, are sickening and deadening. And if it be the part of civilization to maim, rob, and thwart, then what is progress? I am going to venture that the man who sat on the ground in his teepee, meditating on life and its meaning, accepting the kinship of all creatures, and acknowledging unity with the universe of things, was infusing into his being the true essence of civilization." As the civil rights and anti-war movements developed in the 1960s, Indians were already gathering their energy for resistance, thinking about how to change their situation, beginning to organize. In 1961, 500 tribal and urban Indian leaders met in Chicago. Out of this came another gathering of university-educated young Indians who formed the National Indian Youth Council. Mel Tom, a Paiute Indian, their first president, wrote, "There is increased activity over on the Indian side. There are disagreements, laughing, singing, outbursts of anger, and occasionally some planning. Indians are gaining confidence and courage that their cause is right. The struggle goes on. Indians are gathering together to deliberate their destiny." Around this time, Indians began to approach the United States government on an embarrassing topic: treaties. In his widely read 1969 book, Custer Died for Your Sins, Vine Deloria Jr. noted that President Lyndon Johnson talked about America's commitments and President Nixon talked about Russia's failure to respect treaties. He said, "Indian people laugh themselves sick when they hear these statements." The United States government had signed more than 400 treaties with Indians and violated every single one. For instance, back in George Washington's administration, a treaty was signed with the Iroquois of New York. The United States acknowledged all the land within the aforementioned boundaries to be the property of the Seneca Nation. But in the early 60s, under President Kennedy, the United States ignored the treaty and built a dam on this land, flooding most of the Seneca Reservation. Resistance was already taking shape in various parts of the country. In the state of Washington, there was an old treaty taking land from the Indians but leaving them fishing rights. This became unpopular as the white population grew and wanted the fishing areas exclusively for themselves. When state courts closed river areas to Indian fishermen in 1964, Indians had fish-ins on the Nisqually River in defiance of the court orders and went to jail, hoping to publicize their protest. A local judge the following year ruled that the Puyallup tribe did not exist and its members could not fish on the river named for them, the Puyallup River. Policemen raided Indian fishing groups, destroyed boats, slashed nets, manhandled people, arrested 7 Indians. A Supreme Court ruling in 1968 confirmed Indian rights under the treaty, but said a state could regulate all fishing if it did not discriminate against Indians. The state continued to get injunctions and to arrest Indians fishing. They were doing to the Supreme Court ruling what whites in the South had done with the 14th Amendment for many years, ignoring it. Protests, raids, arrests continued into the early 70s. Some of the Indians involved in the fish-ins were veterans of the Vietnam War. One was Sid Mills, who was arrested in a fish-in at Frank's Landing on the Nisqually River in Washington on October 13, 1968. He made a statement. "I am a Yakima and Cherokee Indian, and a man. For 2 years and 4 months, I've been a soldier in the United States Army. I served in combat in Vietnam until critically wounded. I hereby renounce further obligation in service or duty to the United States Army. My first obligation now lies with the Indian people, fighting for the lawful treaty to fish in usual and accustomed water of the Nisqually, Columbia, and other rivers of the Pacific Northwest, and in serving them in this fight in any way possible. My decision is influenced by the fact that we have already buried Indian fishermen returned dead from Vietnam, while Indian fishermen live here without protection and under steady attack. Just 3 years ago today, on October 13, 1965, 19 women and children were brutalized by more than 45 armed agents of the state of Washington at Frank's Landing on the Nisqually River in a vicious, unwarranted attack. Interestingly, the oldest human skeletal remains ever found in the Western Hemisphere were recently uncovered on the banks of the Columbia River, the remains of Indian fishermen. What kind of government or society would spend millions of dollars to pick upon our bones, restore our ancestral life patterns, and protect our ancient remains from damage, while at the same time eating upon the flesh of our living people? We will fight for our rights."